I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Keith Bellows may have the best job in America. He's editor-in-chief of National Geographic Traveler, and today he'll tell us about the must-see cities on his list of top destinations. And then we'll talk about the land use policies that make cities good places to live with Keith Schneider of Michigan Land Use Institute and Brad Lander at the Pratt Center for Community Development. Amsterdam, Dubai, Detroit, New York, we'll talk about all those cities and more today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Keith Bellows' job is to get around. He is editor-in-chief of National Geographic Traveler magazine, and he's here to tell us about some of the key destinations from around the world. Keith, you travel worldwide. What is the most exciting city in the world today?
It's a really tough question because I think it depends on what your sort of travel IQ is. I mean, some people like quiet, bucolic places. Some people like, you know, really frenzied, energy-enriched places. It's probably Dubai because Dubai is the city these days that's on steroids. There's a ton of building going on there. They're trying to put themselves on the map not only as a tourist destination, but as a medical center, a financial center, an economic center. In every respect, it's the sort of the city with the greatest amount of kind of chutzpah. It's a place that actually has such a huge tourist extravaganza. They're building some islands there that you can actually see from outer space. So it's quite the destination.
Is there a new city on your radar that you think our listeners should visit?
Again, I go back to this idea of each of us has certain kinds of cities that they like. My personal favorite, I have two of them right now. One is Barcelona. I'm actually writing a script for a podcast. We do a tours of a lifetime, walking tours of a lifetime on iTunes, and I'm writing the script on Barcelona. And it's been about 2 years since I've been there, but boy, it just reminded me what a great city Barcelona is. It's got the energy. It's got the art. I mean, this is a place that, Picasso and Gaudi and Miro really grew up in. So I think that's a place that is really worth a visit. And the other one is my hometown of Montreal, which is a little closer in terms of visiting. And it truly is the place where you've got, the crossroads of America and Europe. It is a small town with just world-class values.
Amsterdam is featured on the September cover of National Geographic Traveler. It's often the city where you catch your connecting flight when traveling on to other parts of Europe. What makes the city of Amsterdam worthy of cover coverage?
Well, again, you think of the world-class cities, and of course, your mind drifts to Rome and London and Paris and the usual suspects. But, first of all, it's the 400th anniversary of Rembrandt's birth. He is the guy in Amsterdam. But more importantly, I think we need to start recognizing cities that sort of have a sense of themselves, they haven't sold themselves off to tourists. They really are places that are where people actually live. And I'm not to say that, the cities that I mentioned before aren't those kinds of places. But Amsterdam is a small town, four canals, that really has a sense of itself. I mean, this was a place where a lot of, those of us who were sort of backpacking around Europe cut our teeth. I mean, the places where we go to the small bars and drift down the canals and go to the museums. It's a walking town. It's a town that has a small scale, but it's a town that really, really knows who it is.
For those of us who prefer exploring city streets, neighborhoods, great coffee bars, which are the don't-miss districts in Amsterdam?
Well, all of the cities these days are trying to sort of reclaim their past and some of the sort of seedier areas of, you look at New York and, we're all those cities are trying to sort of get back some of the areas that perhaps have escaped the city. And the same is true of Amsterdam. The Eastern Docklands area, which was a pretty, blighted area, is really the kind of place to go. And one of my personal favorites is the Nine Streets area, which, and I sort of speak on behalf of my wife, but I mean, this is where there's tons of boutiques and antique stores, and it is really a wonderful, small-scale kind of shopping extravaganza. Nothing that you will find back home. And this is something that I think all of us look for is you don't want to find a street where you've got the Gap and the Limited and the Gucci's. You want to find streets where there's something truly unique and original and authentic, and that's an area.
The magazine mentions the Eastern Docklands area as organically integrating residences, workspaces, and shopping venues, serving as a primer in next-wave urban planning. That appeals to me, of course. Can you describe in more detail what kinds of recent development Eastern Docklands has experienced?
Well, I think this is an area where you've got a lot of buildings that were pretty much left to dereliction. And what they've really tried to do is to imbue, bring the artists in, give them a sense of ownership, give them a sense of being able to sort of reinvent their sort of urban landscape. And so what you've got is a multi-use area that has, it's not mall, and it's not just residential, it's integrated. And so you've got this wonderful sort of flavor of the old city with the sort of modernity of great design and great sort of shopping and living experiences.
What makes Amsterdam stand out, in your mind, from other European cities?
I think it is a little bit of its scale. I mean, it does not try to be a grand city. And yet, in its own way, it is a grand city because, you know, it hasn't sold itself off to developers. Also, you've got this, you know, there are very few cities in the world that have such a close affinity with water. You've got four canals. It's a city you can walk, and it's almost a sinuous walk because you're walking along the sort of serpentine path of the canals. This is also a city where you can actually live on the water, literally. You can eat on the water, you can vacation on the water, and you can move on the water. It's a little like Venice in that respect.
You also did a small feature in the September issue on another favorite city, New Orleans. Have you been there lately?
I have not been there since the floods, but I have many, many friends who have. And in fact, our contributing writer, Andrew Nelson, pretty much commutes back and forth and is imploring me almost every day to do any number of blogs and podcasts and so forth in the city. So I sort of feel, you know, like I know what's going on there. And one of our best friends lives there. So, yeah, I have a pretty good affinity for the place.
What is the visitor's experience likely to be today in New Orleans?
There's no positive to what happened to New Orleans or what happened in Thailand, but for this. And it is that it is a city that's rethinking who it is and what its personality is and what its priorities are. And so when you would go to New Orleans 2 or 3 years ago, you would have Bourbon Street. And that was sort of, in a lot of people's minds, New Orleans. And it is a classic New Orleans, but it's not the real New Orleans. There's a lot of other outlying areas of New Orleans that are equally as interesting and important, you know, that really truly have the character of the Cajun community. And I think that what we're seeing now is a reevaluation of its priorities. And so you're not going to change Bourbon Street, but you are going to start to change some of the areas that sort of surround Bourbon Street. And I think the visitor's experience, not today, but I think within, you know, 3 or 4 years, is going to be much, much richer. It's not going to just focus on the tourist area. It's going to extend into, you know, many, many other areas of New Orleans that might have been overlooked in the past.
Do travelers face any inconveniences there?
Oh, totally. I mean, let's face it. I mean, you lost 10,000 hotel rooms or something like that. It's a city refining itself. But that's what's so fascinating, because if you're a traveler, you want to experience a place that's dynamic and that's changing and that is true to itself. And I think that's the wonderful thing about New Orleans, is that you know, go today and you're going to see a New Orleans that's reinventing itself.
And for listeners looking for low-price travel, which website are you currently recommending?
Well, I hate to be self-serving, but we have something called the A-List. It's A is for affordable, and we've been doing it for 3 or 4 years now. And we have a A-List newsletter, which every week delivers the best deals that we can find. And we're pretty strict about this. We don't take advertising. We don't allow advertisers to influence our choices. And what we ask is that everybody who gives us something to consider says the following. It's 15% less than what anybody else would give it to you for, and it's guaranteed. And so what we try to do is, with the A-List, is to give people the best deals every week, and you can get it in your email box. And quite frankly, I would put it up against any kind of deals-driven website or newsletter out there.
You just started a segment in Traveler called The Strange Planet. Tell us about it.
One of the great things about the world these days is how odd it is. So if you think about Ripley's Believe It or Not meets Travel, and I would love to get readers, kind of nominations for that, because it's just what's so weird about the world and yet is so ordinary or so much a fabric of, of contemporary life in other places. So you go to a place like Sri Lanka and there's something that's normal to Sri Lankans, but it's so bizarre to Americans. And so Strange Planet is something we'd love to get some reader reaction to. For instance, the city with the most Rolls Royces per square mile is Hong Kong. A recent study found that Americans average 14 days of paid vacation a year, which is the least among all nations in the world. The the British have 24, the Germans have 27, and of course the French, those hard workers, the French have 39 days. So, it's just kind of cool stuff about the world.
Keith, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Keith Bellows is editor-in-chief of National Geographic Traveler. Keith Schneider, an environmental writer and former national correspondent for the New York Times, is program director of the Michigan Land Institute, a research and advocacy organization he co-founded in 1995. Keith, you've written that the phrases Michigan and recession seem so closely aligned that they are almost indistinguishable. Fair statement?
Absolutely. Since the 1970s, with the exception of a 4 or 5 year period in the 1990s, the state has essentially been in a long slide economically. And it's reflected in very, very slow population growth. It's reflected in very slow income growth, and at this time, declining family incomes. It's reflected in, except for that period in the 90s, kind of a stasis in home value increases, and which is all, kind of related to our auto industry and the diminishment in the size of the American auto industry. And Michigan has more auto-related jobs than any state in the country.
You said that there's been a 35-year decline in the auto industry. 35 years is a long time to pick up the signals. Why were the signals not picked up, not heeded?
Michigan, every state has its unique character, and Michigan's culture is very much rooted in the kind of hierarchical management structure of the auto industry. And so there's this sense that at the top of the corporation, the elites will make decision, and there's great disdain by the elites of the grassroots, and in the plants it would be the plant workers, and of course there's equally great disdain for the grassroots for the elites, and the two levels rarely connect, which is different than in other states, particularly states along the coast. I was just in Portland and Seattle, for instance, in August, doing some reporting for us and for the New York Times, and it just was striking how both of those cities, which are thriving in the metropolitan regions, which were among the fastest growing in the country, they found a way to put the elites and the grassroots together. And they do so by, forming almost serendipitously these convener organizations. And they're different in every city. In Portland, they happen to have a metro government there, so that helps. And in Seattle, they have some very active and energetic and vital business groups that are interested in what they're interested in tying together the elites and the grassroots.
Well, how do they do that?
Well, how do they do that? There is a principle and a culture on the coasts that accepts and embraces the rapid changes that are occurring in the 21st century. And so they understand either, accidentally or on purpose or on both, that swift transition is kind of the modus operandi of this century, and in order to stay economically competitive, they've got to be able to stay abreast of trends. They've got to be able to respond to the new market signals of the 21st century. And when it comes to the kinds of issues that you and I are talking about, land use development, economic strategic goals, those market signals have flipped very quickly. In the 20th century, our basic economic development pattern, our strategic goals, were driven by cheap land, cheap energy, fairly modest demographic growth, rising family and personal incomes, wealthy government able to support the infrastructure for a spread out pattern of development, and competitiveness in our core industries. And all of those market signals have changed dramatically in the 21st century. And the coastal states, maybe because they're more involved in trade, maybe because they're actually closer, you know, psychically and distance to the Pacific Rim countries in the Pacific and, you know, Europe and Africa in the on the East Coast. But in the center of the country, with the exception of a few metropolitan regions like Chicago and Minneapolis, St. Louis to some extent, we in the middle of the country, I fear, is becoming kind of a national backwater. And what's interesting in Michigan is that despite the urgency in the economic realm, there isn't this great deal of storm and drung in the populace here. And I think that's a cultural thing, too. I think one of the great strengths and also a weakness of Michigan is that it's a great place to live. You know, it's a firm place that is almost, you know, doesn't like change and therefore is kind of changeless and is proud of the fact that it's sort of just stays in a static period despite all of these winds of change around it. And people here feel comfort and grounded in that.
And what do you do to shake that up? You've said that it's almost too much to ask inventors to repudiate their own creation, but you said that's exactly what's called for now in Michigan. Where do the change agents come from? You say both the elites and the grassroots, as you characterize them, neither is terribly unhappy with the system as it is.
Well, they're unhappy, but they're not yet willing to take the next step, which is to really embrace a significant change in direction. People in Michigan and in Ohio and in Indiana and Western Pennsylvania and New York, you know, upstate New York, you know, around the Great Lakes, understand that the world has changed. There isn't a consensus in any of these states about what to do about it. Now, on the coasts, whether it's New York or Massachusetts, New England or the Pacific Northwest or California, even in the Carolinas and Florida, there's an understanding that the knowledge-based economies, that knowledge is the kind of fundamental natural resource of the 21st century and how you harvest it and who you bring to the table to help you harvest knowledge, particularly young people, is going to be the key to how your economic competitors in the 21st century. It's not as though we in Michigan don't know that. We have some of the greatest universities in the world here. But we're satisfied in this state to spend billions, literally billions, to educate our best and brightest so that they can go out and build the new economies of Seattle. I can't tell you how many times I, you know, trip across leaders involved in these really advanced discussions about economic strategy and land use and planning and new urbanism and transportation who come from Michigan. I mean, in Seattle, I met two of them. One was a grassroots activist, and one was one of the planning directors in the Seattle Planning Department. Both of them trained here, both of them born here, both of them started their careers here, and both of them were unable to kind of continue that conversation in their careers and had to go elsewhere to continue it. So, you know, we're aware of it, and what does it take to get Michigan to kind of move on this? Well, I think we're going to do what Michigan is comfortable doing, which is to kind of, you know, gradually reach a consensus and hopefully move together.
Will it be too late then?
Well, I'm very concerned that we are, you know, if not falling off a cliff, close to, you know, edging up to the edge. And what's interesting about this state, and I've lived and worked, you know, in many states on both coasts and in the Deep South. When I go out and I talk about what's happening in Michigan, I note that Michigan is kind of flipped with the Carolinas. We are now in the position of where the Carolinas were in the 60s and the 70s.
Oh, that's an interesting comparison.
Everything that, you know, all of the major economic and quality of life indicators that Michigan used to be high in and wanted to be high in, economic well-being, median income growth, housing value growth, job-related growth, where we were really high in the 1960s, we were one of the standout, you know, industrial powerhouse economic sectors. We have now flipped with the Carolinas. Now they're high in all those kinds of indicators, and we're at the bottom. And all the things that we don't want to be high in, and that the Carolinas used to be very high in, rates of poverty, rates of obesity, rates of cardiac, you know, disease, longevity, cost of services, declines in income. So Michigan in the 1990s, for instance, led the nation led the industrial states in the number of young people, talented young, bright people between the ages of 18 and 34 that we shipped out of state. And there's been only an increase in that number. We shipped out 200,000 young people during the 1990s out of this state. And between 2000 and 2005, according to the census data just came out, 165,000 more people have left Michigan. You would think that families here would be concerned about that, but it's almost become, you know, kind of the cultural way of life. Yeah, we educate our young. We enclose them in these safe communities we have in this state, and then we kind of are like the Iroquois nation of the 16th century. We train them and we send them off.
Keith Schneider is co-founder of the Michigan Land Institute. I'll have the second part of my conversation with Keith next week. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Brad Lander about his efforts to make housing affordable in the nation's toughest housing market, New York City. And we'll talk to Otis White about the one quality that all great mayors must have. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, policy can be a tough sell to the public, but you've found one mayor who seems to have the knack for it.
Yeah, it's Greg Nickels, who's the mayor of Seattle. As most politicians know, there are two parts to politics. One part is what you might call the wholesale part, and that's the ability to speak to the public and persuade them to come along with you. Think of Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton as just one of those articulate, persuasive politicians that comes around every once in a while. Great wholesale politicians. And then there are the retail politicians. Then think of Lyndon Johnson. A person who could twist arms, could get things done, could work with other politicians. And the very best politicians have some ability to do both. They can persuade a city council to come along if they're the mayor, and equally they can reach out to the public and persuade the public of their vision. Well, Greg Nickels seems to be one of those rare mayors, and he's the mayor of Seattle, who can do both of those things pretty well. That is, he seems to get his way with a pretty independent city council in Seattle. But the remarkable thing about Nickels is his ability to engage the public, sometimes in what's fairly dry public policy questions. And the thing that kind of caught my eye recently was, on the West Coast, you have to go to the voters for virtually everything. On the East Coast, we tend to think of, the mayors make decisions and city councils make decisions about where we spend money. But in places like Seattle, you got to go to the voters and ask them, will you give us enough money to patch the potholes in this community? So Nickels has become pretty imaginative about getting people engaged in thinking about these things. And very recently, he wanted to put a bond referendum on the ballot for this November to do the most routine stuff to the city streets, like installing pedestrian signals and resurfacing streets and all that kind of stuff. But to get the people excited about it, he held a public contest, and he asked them to nominate what they consider to be the worst traffic problems in Seattle, the bumpiest roads or the worst delays, the most dangerous bike routes, that kind of thing. He actually got more than 700 people who participated in this mayor's contest, and 50 of them named a single street. So I think we know with certainty that there's some problems on North 45th Street in the Wallingford neighborhood, because 50 people out of the 700 said that's the worst place in Seattle. Apparently, the streets there are very rutted, and one said it looked like waves on the street.
We've all seen those streets.
Well, anyway, so he's created what he calls the Dirty Dozen out of these 700 emails. I got a lot of publicity about it. And lo and behold, he actually found a little money in the existing budget to go on out there and fix those waves on North 45th Street.
Interesting. One of the issues in Seattle is that they have these various transportation systems that are all governed by different bodies and aren't connected with one another. And they keep having these fits and starts with their attempts at public transportation. It will be interesting to see if Mayor Nichols turns his attention to that.
He seems to have a knack for capturing the public's attention and for crystallizing some momentum around some issues, so I wouldn't count him out.
It sounds like something all urban leaders can learn from. We'll talk to you next week, Otis.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Brad Lander directs the Pratt Center for Community Development in New York. During Brad's tenure, the Pratt Center has helped to shape a new inclusionary zoning policy to create affordable housing in New York City and to protect the tenure of public housing residents in Staten Island. Brad also teaches affordable housing, real estate development, and community planning at Pratt. Before coming to Pratt in 2003, Brad served for a decade as executive director of the Fifth Avenue Committee, a community-based organization in Brooklyn. Providing affordable housing in hot growth cities is a continuing challenge for urban leaders. Is it possible to provide affordable housing without subsidies?
Well, you can provide housing for some middle-class families without large subsidies if you either set aside some land or build in programs such as inclusionary zoning, which we can talk about more, to get down to real working-class and low-income families in a strong market in a hot-growth city. You almost certainly need subsidies of some kind. Now, those can be public subsidies that come in the form of cash, or they can be inclusionary zoning where you're working with developers and they get the opportunity to make more on market rate housing if they also include some affordable.
And how do they make more on market rate housing?
You essentially either let them build more market rate housing than you would otherwise, or you can actually just require it. Inclusionary zoning basically says, all right, here's how much you're allowed to build. We'll let you build a bit more and maybe give you some other advantages as well. But either you only get those benefits if you choose to include affordable units in the development or nearby, or you pay into a fund. Or we'll give you those advantages, but you have to build affordable housing. And some, a couple of hundred cities now have now adopted what's called mandatory inclusionary zoning, where they say, we'll give you those advantages, we'll let you build a bit more market rate housing as well, but in every development over some size, you've got to include affordable units.
When there are subsidies, either to the developer or the eventual homeowner, should those subsidies be converted to private gain? The subsidized owner gets to sell her house and profit from the subsidy, or should the subsidy somehow be retained for the public good?
Well, it's a great and interesting question, and I think the answer depends on your context. You know, in the period of time when, you know, New York was not so long ago a city with a lot of abandonment, and there's still obviously a lot of weak marketplaces around the country, and where you're trying to spark development and where you've really got a context in which the market's not operating and your problem is how to generate investment rather than how to maintain long-term affordability, then I think it's appropriate to let people benefit to some amount. I mean, I think sharing that benefit, trying to get people to stay there a long time, so making it so that if they would sell within the next couple of years, they don't make much. But over time, they have the ability to see some appreciation, makes sense. In places like New York City right now, where the real challenge is how do we make it an affordable place for a wide range of people for the long term, I think we need to really make sure that when those units are resold, that the next buyer is also a person of about the same means. And that does mean really restricting folks' ability to make a lot of money on sale. We went and actually did some research on this, and what we concluded is if you just say the next buyer forever essentially has to be about at the same relative place in the income scale, you use this determination called what percentage of the area median income is that person earning. That area median income, at least in New York City and the New York metro area, has risen on a nice gradual scale. Over time, it's beat the rate of inflation, almost doubled it, not quite, but almost doubled the rate of inflation, but been well below, hot market speculation. So you make something, but you don't make a killing, and the unit is still affordable to the next buyer. And certainly in hot marketplaces, that's what we're advocating as a model of what I'd call permanently affordable homeownership, with some of the benefits of homeownership, but the ability to make sure those units remain affordable for the long term.
I've read that land trusts are one strategy for maintaining affordability over time. Explain how that works.
A land trust is essentially a vehicle for doing what I've just said. What I just talked about, kind of tying it to this area median income, is sort of a formula. Then you need some way of making that happen. Probably the best example in the country is in Burlington, Vermont, the Burlington Community Land Trust, although it's one of hundreds around the country. And they actually titled a report that they recently did on their 25 years of history, Permanently Affordable Homeownership. And what they showed was their buyers who have bought and stayed for a while and sold have made some money, done better than they would have done if they were renters, and yet the units stayed affordable to future buyers as well.
For many years, your work focused on development in Brooklyn. Development there is now exploding. What are the challenges posed by that development?
Yeah, well, let me sort of start first by just, you know, I think partly what's so interesting for Brooklyn communities is this just total paradigm shift from a context in so many places of abandonment, where what had happened was folks had fled the city, neighborhoods really faced abandoned buildings and a lot of problems that went along with that. High crime, lack of jobs, you know, poor schools, poor investment in quality of life in neighborhoods. And so what the Pratt Center for Community Development did for many years was help those groups bring their neighborhoods back, rehab abandoned buildings to be affordable housing, create childcare, create jobs, bring in businesses, you know, kind of invent the field of community development, which in many ways was founded in Bedford-Stuyvesant in central Brooklyn and you know, has been used all over the Brooklyn, all over the city, all over the country to great effect. Really, in a dramatic shift just in the last 10 years, I would say. I mean, there were always certainly some parts of Brooklyn that stayed strong and saw earlier stages of gentrification. But over the last 10 years, what's happened is just a dramatic shift from this kind of paradigm of abandonment to a paradigm of growth and development, led really by a few different forces, certainly very substantially by immigration. I mean, what's led to population increases in Brooklyn and in New York City as a whole is not the yuppies and the professionals, though that's certainly been an important trend, but immigrants coming from all over the world. Brooklyn actually and New York City as a whole continues to actually lose net white families and middle-income African-American and Puerto Rican families. And what we've added in the city as a whole, more than a million over the last 20 years and projected to add another million, are people from the Caribbean, from Asia, from Latin America. So partly as a result of that growth and then partly as a result of gentrification and the perception of a whole lot of Brooklyn neighborhoods as great places to live, property values have just skyrocketed and development is taking place in every corner of the borough, even in the really what had been historically very low-income neighborhoods, East New York and Bedford-Stuyvesant, Crown Heights, you know, even Cypress Hills, Ocean Hill-Brownsville. So folks are grappling with a whole range of issues. Certainly number one on the list of a lot of groups that we work with is housing affordability. Folks are happy not to have abandoned neighborhoods and to see their neighborhoods be vibrant places. But if tenants are under increasing pressure and find it harder and harder to stay, and if young people can't find an affordable place to live, it's hard to take advantage of a neighborhood that's gotten better. And housing prices, what they've done. Actually, the one-year increase from just 2004 to 2005 in housing prices, the greatest in the city was in the neighborhood where Pratt is, actually, Fort Greene and Clinton Hill, long-time kind of African-American, had been working-class neighborhood, rapidly gentrified. The one-year increase in average sales prices from 2004 to 2005 was 42%. So that's great if you bought and sold, but if you're trying to live in the neighborhood, trying to buy in the neighborhood, trying to rent in the neighborhood, or have been a renter for a long time, very difficult. In addition, though, to those affordability challenges, there are real neighborhood quality of life and livability issues that people are grappling with as, you know, the infrastructure, the public schools and the transportation system struggle to kind of keep up with development. Even, you know, the places to park your car or the open space you have, which isn't enough in so many neighborhoods. And then on top of all of that, we have a couple of these mega projects like Brooklyn Atlantic Yards that folks just feel deeply ambivalent about. It includes a lot of housing and a lot of affordable housing. So some affordable housing groups like Acorn are big supporters of it. But it is at a scale much larger than anything else, extremely dense, will certainly add to traffic. And so a whole set of folks that live nearby have fought deeply against it. And I think those strains of growth, on the one hand, what the market wants to do and what kind of growth calls for, on the other, how to make that opportunity that's shared and not just goes to folks that have a lot of money, but to the majority of New Yorkers that are working class folks, immigrants, you know, African Americans, longtime residents, and still to create sustainable, livable neighborhoods that folks want to live in is, you know, are the challenges that people here and, you know, it seems like increasingly around the country are wrestling with.
Can growth be made to work for low and moderate income communities?
Yes, it can. It takes thoughtful planning and a lot of organizing for those folks, because it's not the natural course of how development happens. I mean, of course, what a developer is looking to do is make the most money that they can. And so they'd like to build the densest project at the highest incomes that the market will bear. But what folks have found around the country are a lot of tools to make sure that the benefits are shared better. We talked already about inclusionary zoning. You can just require that when development takes place, or you can create strong incentives so that a good chunk of the units are affordable for people. You can put provisions in place so that the jobs pay well. You know, Chicago just passed this law, the city council just passed a law earlier this week requiring that big box retailers pay a living wage. Not better than what the best were paying. You know, it's like what Costco was providing its workers, but a lot better than what Walmart provides is its. So you can make sure the jobs pay well. And on new development, there's construction jobs, there's building service jobs, there's retail jobs, there's hospitality jobs. Those jobs can be made to be living wage jobs. And you could, there's a lot of cities. Minneapolis has a great program to make sure that folks in those neighborhoods are trained for and have a first shot at getting those jobs. So on the housing side, on the job side, a lot of folks working on the education and childcare sides as well. How do you make sure that the schools and the childcare infrastructure that gets created as growth takes place reserves meaningful and high-quality slots for low and moderate income residents, both those that have been there for a long time and those that might come into the affordable units? All those things take work, and they all take building up political power. It's interesting, in New York City, certainly the folks have organized and built those into some but not all of the development plans. I'm certainly really excited to watch what happens in Los Angeles now, where Mayor Villaraigosa really has announced a challenge both to keep the city growing and to be part of the sort of social justice, labor, and community movement that he comes from, to make sure that those benefits are really shared equally. And I really do think that's the challenge.
If you had the public policy prescription for it, what would that look like? What are the top two or three things, Brad, that you would recommend?
I mean, on the housing side, I don't think there is a silver bullet. I do think that you want to leverage growth and make sure that as development takes place, some percentage of it is affordable. But that never going to accommodate all the people that are already in your city and need to keep affordable housing. So I think we're tremendously lucky in New York City to have a good system of rent regulations. And I think a lot of cities that had that after World War II gave it up and thought, gee, we don't do that. That's price controls. But I think hot market cities are going to have to look at it again. And I think it's one of the only things in New York City that keeps about a third of our families able to know they can stay next year, that, you know, their rent's going to go up a little bit. It's going to cover the cost. Landlords are going to continue to make money, as they certainly are throughout New York. But that if all of a sudden overnight real estate in their neighborhood is worth twice what it was, their rent can't be doubled. And that protects about a million households in New York, and increasingly is absolutely critical. So I really think rent regulations are critical. And then increased effort to make sure the affordable housing that we have created over time stays affordable. We're lucky to have actually awfully good public housing in New York, which not every city in the country does, and we need to keep making sure we invest in it. We have a lot of housing, affordable housing, that was built in the 70s that we have to make sure stays affordable. And then we're also lucky in New York City, and, you know, we're one of the very few places in the country that puts a good deal of its own capital into creating and preserving new affordable housing. And I think it's funny, that was actually put in place at this time of abandonment. What Mayor Koch realized was the city was at risk of being abandoned, and it was in the city's not only affordable housing interest, but just core infrastructure, stay a viable city interest to invest in housing. And actually, more money was being put at that time than now, but Mayor Bloomberg, to his credit, and our housing commissioner, Sean Donovan, and a lot of advocates who pushed for it have gotten that number back up. So we're putting real dollars into affordable housing. And if cities aren't willing to do that, you know, use regulatory tools and put money in, it takes some combination of those things to keep affordable housing in a strong market city. On the economic and workforce development side, there really are some good models of places where folks say, you know, as part of planning for economic development, and especially where it's sort of led by real estate development, even before we're not going to think about the jobs, making them good and making them go to local residents and training people for them as an afterthought. We're going to build them into our upfront planning. And I'd point to Boston and Minneapolis here as two cities that systematically think about that, you know, so that as soon as a thinking is begun on a development project, they're planning for the workforce development. Who's going to get those jobs? How do we start training them? How do we make sure they're good? And if we're putting public energy into that project, public dollars, a rezoning, some kind of public approvals, How do we go for even more and try to make sure those jobs are good? And then finally, I would say one issue that people are increasingly grappling with here are those issues of sustainability and livability. How do we generate the energy? How do we deal with the waste? How do we make sure cities can handle growth, whether that's traffic or urban scale? And I do think that takes a recommitment to a kind of urban planning or city planning that I think we haven't done enough of, and also creating conversation between folks that have some expertise in those fields and people in the neighborhoods and community organizations that really are the ones who know what they want. And, you know, if you approach people with, we're putting this development in your neighborhood, you know, like it or not, they generally oppose, often in any case. I think what some cities have found that have tried to take a more proactive planning approach, sit down with neighborhoods and say, look, here are the growth projections for the city. That means we need to do more to share the benefits and burdens of that growth. Everyone's going to have to take their fair share, but we'll involve you in planning for it. You know, places like Portland and Minneapolis, but also places like Rochester and New York have really done pretty well with that. And, you know, one recent example in New York was this solid waste management plan, where for the first time, folks in Manhattan are dealing with their share of Manhattan solid waste. And that had made a big difference in helping community-based environmental justice organizations that we work with around the city feel like, okay, you know, waste is increasing, but our communities, which have long had a disproportionate share, aren't being asked to take an even more disproportionate share. And folks got on board and really said, we'll have to figure out some new ways to do this, but we've got to have a plan to share it fairly, and we've got to have a plan to involve communities in planning for what it's going to look like.
You hinted at this, but I want to come back to it. You've written about standards for publicly supported private development. In other words, if as a private developer I am going to get certain public supports, then I owe the community more than simply my development. What should those standards be?
That's right. Well, I think it depends on the project. I was very intrigued by what they did in Chicago earlier this week, where they tied it to the kind of industry. They said a set of prevailing wage for retail jobs. And I think what you want to do is use public action to lift up job quality and health benefits, not beyond what the industry or the businesses can sustain, because of course it's the businesses that are providing those jobs. But if we're going to put money in, if we're going to, you know, take our public dollars, or certainly where we use eminent domain, and we're going to take the power the state has to take people's property, we've got to make sure that the jobs we're providing are at the top of that category. So if they're retail jobs, they got to be the best retail jobs that there can be. And, you know, this is a good example where Costco doesn't have a business that is that different from Walmart, but they provide a better wage and benefit standard. And if we're going to use public dollars on those kind of projects, we got to make sure that happens. And, you know, that can be true on almost any kind of project. It certainly needs to be true on the construction jobs. But it's true in hotels and retail and all kinds of sectors. And I think for too long, and again, this is where I think strong market cities have to think differently, for too long, economic development subsidies have been a sort of race to the bottom, you know, a pleading with business, please come here, we'll stop taxing you, we'll give you whatever you need. You know, in some places, unfortunately, they continue not to have businesses that want to locate there. But in places like New York and like so many other places around the country now, whether that's San Francisco or South Florida or parts of Chicago, it's you're in a position to say, we see what's happening with real estate values. We want growth and development. But if we're going to invest here, yeah, we're going to make sure that the wages get set minimally at an amount that's sort of enough to sustain your family on. We're going to think about whether that's, you know, the best job in that sector that it can be. We're going to think about who gets those jobs, and we're going to require you to participate in a public system that trains people and matches them. You know, Minneapolis has this great program I started to mention before, the Neighborhood Employment Network, where in the mayor's office is staffed a nonprofit organization that works citywide with neighborhood-based, community-based employment organizations all around the city. And when they do a large-scale project or any project that the city's involved in, they pair them with one of those skilled community-based employment and training groups. And they make sure that not only do local residents know about the job, but they're prepared for it. They get a first shot at it. You know, and I think you're starting to see more and more cities realize if we're using our economic development subsidies can't be a cookie jar or a candy store. We shouldn't start from a position that we're desperate for anything. Instead, we have to be smart and make good deals with developers and businesses so that the subsidies and the public energy that's being provided genuinely bring our citizens the kind of opportunities that they want and need.
Just one more question. In the case of Chicago, Brad, big box retail minimum wage law that was passed, which has not yet been signed nor vetoed by the mayor. The mayor's still thinking about it. Target has already announced the cancellation of a project it intended to do. It had announced it would do in on the south side of Chicago. And I expect to see Walmart do some of the same things with cancellations, thereby costing jobs, you know the litany, costing jobs, costing sales tax to the city, and then costing access to lower price goods in neighborhoods that don't always have that access. What's your response to that? Where's the equilibrium?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I am confident. You know, I looked at some of the financial modeling that the Brennan Center for Justice and others did. And, you know, in some ways we have the same issues here around inclusionary zoning where developers said, well, we just won't build, you know, if we're required to include affordable housing. And, you know, I guess I am confident that Target and Walmart can make money in Chicago and could make money in New York meeting a good standard. Now, they know that they'll – if they start having to do that in places and all around the country, they'll make a little bit less. And they're invested in preventing cities from kind of getting into their business and making sure that the wages are decent. And so I don't honestly think that they've made an economic calculus that they wouldn't make money in Chicago. I think they've made a political calculus that they want to try to keep cities from passing ordinances of this type. I've been pleased, you know, last year when New York City passed a modestly similar law, mostly for grocery stores and providing health care, those employers like John Castamatidis from Gristiti's, Big Apple, spoke up and said, you know what, we can do this, we make money, and others should do it as well. And so what I hope over time is that those folks that comply will join in a coalition that says, you know what, we can make this work. There certainly is a balance. I mean, we need growth and development in our cities to create jobs and make them work. And you could imagine imposing regulatory burden, whether in housing or job conditions, that seriously was so severe that it made business development impossible. I don't think the Chicago law does that. I know the New York City Healthcare Security Act and the inclusionary zoning laws don't. It is in negotiation and dialogue, but I think it takes building some strong political will, running the numbers for sure, and making sure that, you know, we get that balance, that we have job creation, but that we also have good jobs.
Well, we'll see how it plays out locally. It points out the difficulty of acting locally in the absence of federal standards that then put no community on an unlevel playing field, if you will.
Absolutely. And if the choice were do it at the local level or do it at the national level, even the state level or the regional level, then I would certainly say it's better to create a level playing field across the country or at least across an economic region for sure. And that would be better than looking to cities to go it alone. In the absence of political will to do it at these larger scales, I think hot market cities are really at a unique moment in time where they may be able to say, we want growth. But we also, given the fact that our cities are becoming polarized, rich and poor, becoming hard places to afford, we need to use this moment to use the local powers that we have and hope that the suburbs and our states and the countries follow, but show some leadership now. And I give credit to, you know, Mayor Bloomberg here and to the Chicago City Council and Mayor Villaraigosa in Los Angeles. And I do think it's going to be a time. It's become a time of experimentation for what kind of policies will make hot market cities more affordable and livable places. And hopefully we'll learn a lot over the next few years.
Brad, thanks for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you so much.
Brad Lander directs the Pratt Center for Community Development in New York. Be prepared, counsels the motto of the Boy Scouts of America. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith explains that how we go about achieving this state of readiness is equally as important.
The first time I took a river trip through the Grand Canyon, I took 60 pounds of gear. It was a 3-week wilderness trip, so I wanted to make sure I had all the essentials. but 60 pounds is a lot of stuff. In fact, 20 pounds more than recommended. I didn't come close to using it all. On my second trip, I took 51 pounds of gear, still more than I needed. On my third trip through the Grand Canyon, I was determined to take only what I would use. I made a list to follow. But when it came time to pack, I couldn't make myself stick to it. I kept throwing in extra things just in case. I wound up with 46 pounds of gear, still way more than needed. On my next trip, I took 34 pounds, and still I never came close to using it all. I can't seem to get it right. The fact of the matter is that I am addicted to being surrounded by things and possessions, whether I use them all or not. But I am not alone in this. Everybody I know is obsessed with stuff. America has a major attachment to things. Americans, rich and poor, have more stuff than people in any civilization in the history of the world, and yet still we want more and more. Mind you, this is not to say that commerce is bad. It is not. The marketplace is a very good thing. But when commercialism totally consumes us, we have too much of a good thing. When I think back on my Grand Canyon trips, I am surprised by how much time I've spent dealing with my gear. I pack it, I unpack it, I sort it and rebag it, I paw through it looking for things, and I scurry around getting my things together. And the more time I spend sorting, packing, collecting, and organizing, the less time I spend with the Grand Canyon itself. I've learned that the less gear I bring along, the more I am able to immerse myself in the wonder of that place. All I need is the bare minimum to get the maximum experience out of my time in the Grand Canyon. The moral here for all of us is that the more stuff we accumulate, the more we become absorbed in nothing but material concerns. Yet social scientists have shown conclusively that material superabundance is not related to our fulfillment and spiritual well-being. Money is not correlated with happiness. A surfeit of choice makes us less satisfied, not more. The worries of work, debt, upkeep, and competition detract from the quality of our lives. The lesson I've learned from the Grand Canyon is about the happy medium it takes to live a life in full. The best things in life may or may not be free, but it is certainly less taxing to enjoy them, whatever they cost, when we free ourselves from all of the clutter that gets in the way. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.